and welcome to this week's edition of Books and Booze. We're here with Amanda Gallen, well-known editor, short story writer. I don't know if there's anything she doesn't do. This is Renee, and I am again drinking a Werewolf by Newcastle because I bought a case of it. Amanda, how are you doing, and what are you drinking?
I am doing very, very well. I'm drinking water right now. I was drinking coffee earlier, and it seemed like it was making me too, like, so I took a couple of shots of NyQuil, so I'm hoping that will, like, balance out somewhere really good, maybe.
Awesome.
I think I've done that on one episode before.
You have.
Very interesting.
Blue Moon Pumpkin Ale again, because it's almost Halloween, and I want to make sure I get in my fix before it's gone.
And Dakota?
I'm actually just sticking to regular Newcastle tonight. A little boring, but not bad. When I can afford it, I like the darker beers.
Okay. So we're going to start tonight talking about Cipher Sisters, which is the book that you co-edited with Michael Paul Gonzalez, right?
Yes. Yes.
And you had your story in that called Asymmetry, which is basically, and it's a super short story, so I don't want to say too much about it because you just have to read that. But it's twins raising a daughter together, that it's one of their daughters. And the story itself, it feels like a dream almost. And there's the lack of quotation marks, which I think really adds to that sort of feeling that it just has this very dreamlike flow to it through this whole thing. But the mothers, I'm going to call them mothers, the twins. One of them is the mother. You don't know who. The daughter doesn't even know which one is her mother. Super creepy, kind of. Super creepy ladies.
Well, it's sort of interesting, like, how the entire, like, concept of, like, the anthology. Mike found this story about two real-life twins. Their names were Joan and Patricia Miller, and they had been recluses and lived alone, you know, their whole lives. And no one knew really anything about them, and they had always listed each other as their emergency contacts. And so for like 40 years, no one knew anything about them, and then they found them, and they had died like in their 70s, like days apart, like of natural causes, like in their house. And there was like a press release where they were trying to find any type of family. And Mike found this story, and he sent it to me. And, you know, we kind of started talking about it and talking about, you know, other stories that reminded us of and like all of these things that could be done with it, this idea of like what these twins could be doing. And then it was like, oh, someone should write a story about this, and it was like, no, a lot of people should write a story, you know, like stories about, like, how this, you know, no, a lot of people could do this. There are so many different things. But the story that I have in the anthology is sort of maybe kind of a pseudo sequel, maybe to another story that I might have written somewhere else that might have reminded Mike of the original press release about the sisters.
It's very cryptic, the way that you explain that.
Well, I mean, it's sort of like if this other story really did happen and the events that ended this story really did happen, then this might be a sequel to it if those things were true and not also dreamed. Then this could be a continuation of that dream or a continuation of the truth of that story, which makes, like, no sense. Like, I meant that to, like, make total, like,
what is the other story?
I get it. Yeah, what's the other story? We want to know.
That's a clue. It's another clue. No, it's the story that I had in Warmed and Bound.
Okay.
That was sort of the conversation that kind of spawned the idea.
I think I know what the answer is, but then I feel like I'll feel stupid if I'm wrong, so I never want to say it, so I had to make you say it. Okay. Go ahead.
I want to hear you say it.
Yeah.
Do you find that happening often, or at, like in any other instance where you just sort of feel like something, an idea or, you know, prompt or something like that fits with another story and you kind of go back to those same ideas or even like the same characters and maybe you rename them and work it out a little bit? Or is this like something that you just did in this case?
I actually have, like, my characters pop up all over the place. Like, I don't notice that a lot of times, and then I end up realizing that I've changed the names of people and that they've just come back in other stories anyway. I think that this, like, sort of this sequel was kind of like what it would have been in my mind, whether I had ever included it in anything or ever maybe even written it down. I kind of thought about how that would all play out. But I think, like, I only have, like, a cast of like maybe like 20 characters in my head, and they just keep playing and with different names, like in different stories, like all over the place.
Well, then, see, I asked for purely selfish reasons because I wanted to know if that was like normal or okay. Because I think that I probably have like a set, like maybe less than 20. Someone was saying that Joss Whedon has all the same characters in everything that he writes, and you can, like, identify them if you watch enough.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, and I think it does happen, and then it takes a while, and then you recognize them, and then you kind of have to go, I thought that was new, and then go, actually, it's fine. It's a good person. It's a good character. I wondered what they were doing 20 years earlier or later.
So how... the story selections that went into Cypher Sisters, how involved were you in that process? Did you read every one? Did you help decide that final running order?
Yeah, we worked. I mean, Mike did all the hard work. Like, I got to do all of the fun stuff. Like, I was involved in the fun part of the process, which was just basically picking stories. We got a lot more submissions than we expected for something. I mean, it's a very, very specific prompt to go, they were born this year, they died this year, you can't write about death, you can't write, we know exactly, you know, pick something, it can't be too far sci-fi, it can't be too, you know, it's very specific, these are their names, and we got a lot of really, really good stories, so we basically went through and we just said, okay, we're both going to read all of the submissions, and we'll make an ideal list. And, you know, each, and then we'll get together and kind of hash it out. And the hashing out process of, like, our two lists took, like, an hour. Because we the stories that we picked were pretty much the same stories. I mean, it just took basically, I mean, really, it was, like, an hour to come up with, like, the final table of contents. Yeah, I mean, there was no, like, fist fights or, like, you know, I'm not sticking to you for, like, 2 weeks, you know, this is crazy, you know, or... No, it was just kind of like, oh, yeah, actually, yeah, that's good, too. Also very good, yeah. And then, you know, starting to collect pictures. But, you know, once again, you know, Mike did all the hard work with that stuff. He knows how to do the layouts. He did all of that work. And his wife, Alex, is, you know, also, she's an amazing photographer. So a lot of the images were her archived images and pictures that Mike had taken. And then once again, I got to just send in a bunch of pictures that I wanted, and they figured out, and Mike figured out how to lay all of that out. And
the book itself is gorgeous.
I am so proud of it. It's like a baby. It's like, it's so beautiful, and you know, and there are little like pictures in there where I'll go, oh, those are my feet. Oh, those are my sister's legs. Oh, that's a picture my son took, and they're all kind of hidden in there, like, you know, just spread out. So, I'm really, really proud of the way it turned out.
Truly,
I love it.
I just raved about, I mean, it's just spectacular to see. I'm jealous I'm not in this book because it's so pretty. So
I'm super jealous, too, because, you know, I saw the prompt and I was like, that sounds cool, and then I forgot about it. And then
it was...
came out and it's so good.
But it is one of those things where it's so specific. Like, if an idea doesn't strike you, Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you have to come up with something that's, like, perfect. And there are so many things that, you know, that does happen where you see these anthologies and you go, I want to be in this. Or you see a magazine and you go, I want to do something for this. And then you just go, I don't have anything for that. I have no specific. And, you know, and you just can't force it, you know, and turn in something crap just to be turning something in and hoping.
Mm-hmm.
But I do remember, like, months ago, I mean, a really long time ago now, I guess, we had D.B. Cox on. And he had let us read.
I love him.
His story that appears.
Isn't he wonderful?
And that story is amazing. And he's such a nice guy. And so that was a really pointless story. But I feel like there's been a buzz about this book for a while, and it definitely delivered on that. And I think it's cool that it's a quality book as far as the content, and also a lot of effort was put into making it look cool and feel cool. And if I was like showing my husband the forehead, like, look, okay, now look at it now.
Yeah, bend it this way. Yeah, it has that definite, like, scrapbook, like, keeper kind of picture book you want to, yeah.
I started to make a list of, like, my favorite stories getting ready for this, and then I realized, like, well, this is ridiculous because I'm writing down the names of, like, half of these stories. So I don't have much of a list to really help me, you know. Like, you should check it. Just read all these stories. So when you were deciding on them, because there's a lot of very short stories and then there's some longer ones, you know, Did you put any favoritism towards those shorter stories, or did it just happen to turn out that way?
It just happened to turn out that way. I mean, there were definitely we got a lot of vaudeville stories. Like, people definitely stuck to, like, a few themes, like, more than others. Like, there were a lot of stories where they were spies, and there were a lot of stories where the twins were performers. So you kind of have to pick the best of those.
Right.
And, you know, you kind of have to really go, okay, we can only take so many circus stories. We can only really do so many of each age. You, too, have to try to spread it out, too. You know, we're going to have so many from their childhood and so many. So, you know, there were automatically, like, breakdowns in categories to try to pick the best of, but also try to span sort of the life.
I'm going to call it a detail, but I mean it's a story. There was a story called Mercy by Rebecca L. Brown, and it was almost not about the sisters, but it was about a doll that they had.
Mm-hmm.
And that was so, like, I got to that one, and it was such a refreshing little, like, oh, that's sort of brilliant to take this idea and then take that small little bit out of the idea and make it. I don't know. I don't know how to describe it, but it was just a really affecting story for me.
That was definitely one of Mike's picks. I'm going to give him a lot of credit here because he did a lot of the work. I mean, he did a lot of the work. But, yeah, it was a nice little...
Johnson kind of similar, where the twins actually played a really minor role in the story, but the story was really, really... kind of unsettling, and, like, it gets under your skin and really makes you think. And in the end, you do, I feel like you think about the twins more than you think about the other elements because they were so minor and you don't really know why they're there and how they relate to everything. And it kind of, like, makes the wheels turn a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that is such a good story. It really, really, I love that story. Well, I mean, I love them all, but yeah, that one really, really, it stood out as just being so, so different. And it does sort of hinge on them, and it gives you that, like, feeling of, like, history without, like, being too over-focused. And I think that was a good way that the twins could play into a lot of the stories without being, like, these are the two people we're talking about. So it has to be them
so
in the front.
More real by giving them that. The things people own sort of make them more real. And that gives them that idea, like, oh, they had physical things. Now they're real people. And
right.
I think that little thing just gives them that. There were just so many. Truly, the whole book has just a haunting feel to it. especially with this idea that you sort of know that story, that the sisters that you're basing all this on, they just died mysteriously together, and you have all that. And then each story just adds an extra little layer to what could have been and what could have gone on. And there's so many different styles and techniques of writing in here. Sometimes with a short story collection, you can't read it all at once, because you get bogged down with the theme or whatever. And for a themed anthology, I burned right through this because there was so much diversity to what was happening. And I'm trying to think of what the other story was. It had the super long title, The Chance Meeting at the Backstage of the Apollo Theater, Harlem, New York City.
Yes. Yeah.
Loved that story. And it was mirror stories almost to give you the twins, and it's written in columns, and you have the story of one of the twins and then the story of the other twin mirroring it, and it's just such a unique style, and it was so interesting to see it so well executed there in this book. I was just riveted.
That story was brilliantly laid out, and the thing that I loved about the way it all came together was everything was so contradictory that you don't, like, the one thing I think that we both really wanted was for you to not come away with a sense that you knew them after you had read this book. You know, like, the book is sort of, you know, it's a collection of totally different accounts, totally different people, and you have no idea what's true. And so you don't come away from, you know, with a sense like, I'm getting this book, and then when I'm done with it, I'm going to know what these people were like. It's like you know them no less, but then you know so many different versions, you know, 18 different versions of them.
Mm. Yeah, I think we should amend what we say when we have good anthologies on the show, because we've only had good anthologies on the show. It's like, a lot of themed anthologies are hard to read, but then the people that
this one's amazing.
Yeah.
We've been very lucky.
Yeah. I was just thinking that, like, oh, Duska is saying the exact same thing I said to Ross Lockhart about his last anthology, but it's true in both cases. But it's, you know, it's the result of us just having really fucking cool people. Like, we, for some reason, attract awesome works of literature.
We
anyway. One of the things that I loved, this is going to get weird, okay?
Oh,
yeah, bear
with me.
One of the things that I felt like really moved me about this book and got me stoked to read it was your introduction. It was beautiful. And I guess what I want to know is, were you drawn to the idea of this anthology when you and Mike were talking about it because you felt that way about the potential of this new story that you guys were talking about? Or did all of the amazing stories that you got in make you feel that way? Like, by the time you were done, it was such...
The idea, just the idea of putting this together and just putting these, I mean, where you have two actual people that you know nothing about and you have, like, the potential to just make up, you know, these just beautiful things for them. And, I mean, there's nothing. It's a total blank slate, but they're totally, you know, they were real women. And, I mean, just the idea that you can just lay, you know, overlay slide after slide after slide of what might have been. Like, the idea is just, I mean, it's just like a magical idea. And, like, I'm fascinated by the idea of twins. Like, I have always, you know, with the Alice in Wonderland, it's always been the idea that through the looking glass and the idea of the twin being on the other side. And, you know, I always loved the idea of the twins. So I've always been fascinated with this. So you overlay this with this perfect idea of real women. And, you know, and I just imagined that their lives were perfect, you know, for them. And then, you know, you get this other idea and you go, well, actually, other people might have been involved. So what was it like for them?
And I think that's similar to, like, you know, when you see these pictures of abandoned spaces And some of them are like, you know, whatever, but then there'll be that one where, like, the bed is still made or there's a discarded teddy bear on the floor or something that hits you, and it is, it's like a, it's just a visual that is full of potential. But this is almost more exciting because it's two characters that exist, but every writer can take them and make them anything they want, and that makes it
right.
even bigger. So we have a lot to cover on this show today, and I want to make sure that we get as much as we can in. So I'm going to start with some listener questions, and it's funny because Jessica sent me a message that says, let's try to do the serious ones first, and I'm going to blow everybody's mind and say, we're doing the serious questions first, and the first question is from Johnny Gibbings.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sitting down.
All the time.
No, I know, but usually when we ask a question from Johnny, not serious.
Oh, yeah, it's the silly one. But he let us off with a very serious question this time.
Yes, yeah, all three of them are, no, I'm sorry, the first two are, the third one isn't. He is genuinely a fan of your short story prose and how you seem to be able to be vague with characters, yet at the same time leaving hints for the reader to paint the picture. You've written three shorts, and they were very short, Nefarious Muse, he thinks, that were great. So the question is, when are you going to write a full-length novel already?
When are we going to publish a full-length novel, I think is probably the bigger question. I'm working on one right now that I'm really, really happy with. I think everybody has, like, several novels that, like, they write as practice, right? I mean, you spend, like, years, like, writing really bad novels. So, like, I mean, I've written a lot of novels. Like, I have, like, a 500-page vampire novel that I wrote when I was, like, 15. But, like, nothing's going to happen with that. I was practicing.
Right.
But I'm actually working on one now. It's called Boxing Day, and I hope to finish it by spring and start the rounds and do some things with that. So
that's exciting.
Yeah, that is exciting. So Johnny will be very happy.
Yes, he'll be very happy. It's sort of about strippers, a stripper and a priest and a pool hustler and love and escaping the stereotypes and murder and really serious things also.
And then he also
doesn't sound like it goes together, but all the things go together. They go together really nicely. So
I believe you. I feel like it's not a novel until there's a lot of competing ideas that somehow manage to work together.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's hard to put things together in a place where you go, well, it's about a stripper, but actually it's about trying to, you know, break away from stereotypes and being aware of, like, the part that you've played into and change and move forward with your existence. And murder.
Yeah, but isn't it hard when someone asks you what a novel in progress is about, and you're like, well, a lot of things. Actually.
Yeah, and also it's like, and I'm not done, so I'm not sure. It could totally change.
Yeah.
I keep throwing chapters away every day and then writing new ones, and then people, I kill them off
trouble.
And save them for, yeah.
I thought that it was
what
a
do you write?
Novel, but it's
I,
erotic romance.
You know, about people. That's all I write about people.
What a protagonist.
They do.
Mm. Yeah, protagonist, and he faces some challenges.
You should just say unicorns all the time. What do you write about unicorns? They're very serious.
What do you write about?
You don't think they're serious, then obviously you're reading the wrong books about unicorns.
Oh.
And that should be enough to make people leave you alone.
Because believe me, you don't want my real answer. It's really long. Right? That's why I'm writing a book about it. Johnny also wants to know if you're still doing Curiouser and Curiouser, because he, as well as we, fucking love it.
Oh, I loved doing Curiouser and Curiouser. The only problem with that is people are really, really interesting, and I cannot figure out a way to research people and obsessively Google them and stalk their Facebook pages and come up with great questions and do interviews and write stories at the same time.
So
I realized that, like, I was writing very little. Like, I loved doing Curiouser and Curiouser, but I realized that I had stopped writing because I wanted to do interviews, and I was really, really, really into that, and then I was having these other ideas that I was pushing aside and just going, I'll work on that later. I'm going to do this now. And then I had to go, okay, I need to stop doing this for a while, and then I'll write for a while, and then I'll go back to doing interviews for a while. And maybe I could somehow at some point figure out how to do both at the same time. But I have not figured out how to do that yet.
One way you could save time is to just have other people make up questions for you.
We try that, yeah.
For instance,
I'm very particular about my questions. I have very specific things that I want to know about each person. Like, I get really, like, weird about it.
No,
I understand.
I agree, because one of the things that happened when we got this load of listener questions for you is that we were like, oh, well, I guess we don't get to ask our questions.
It's kind of why I sent Renee a little message. I was like, let's just do the serious ones first, because I want to make sure there's time for the things I want to talk about. No offense. It's my podcast.
It's actually, I mean, it's a little bit, I mean, but it is a little bit flattering that people, like, had things that they wanted to, like, ask me, because I was like, I haven't really done that much. I've done some short stories and stuff, but I don't really know what.
But they're good. That's why.
Thank you. Thank you.
So, Christy Ol says, what is the most fun you've had putting a story together?
Most fun I've had putting a story together. A lot of, actually, a few, this has came to, like, something that, like, I don't know if I should admit this or not. But I get a lot of story ideas from, like, a friend that I have, and we have these really strange conversations. And then I'll, like, you know, I'll record our conversations, or I'll, like, transcribe our conversations, or the conversations will be in text, and then I'll be like, I'll email her or call her and be like, I want to use this. You know, like, I think this would actually make a really good story. Or, like, call her and be like, I need a story idea. And she will just say the first thing that comes off the top of her head, and, like, it will. Then I'll be like, okay, that's good, thank you, bye. And then talk to her again a month later. But so the story that was actually in the Nova Parade, about Charlotte and Jolene.
I know a couple of people who were also in Nova Parade.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
So that story was actually fun putting that together. That was actually really fun, because that was just a conversation that we had that I had recorded, and I just wrote all of the dialogue down and inserted the scene. And I laughed and laughed, and then had to go, of course, to her and go, listen, this is okay. Because it was like we actually had this ridiculous conversation. And I just changed the setting, and, you know, it was a phone conversation, and I changed the setting. So that was really fun to, like, make up, like, a fake background and fake characters to have the words that came out of our mouths. So that was fun.
So basically you have a real-life muse.
In a way, I really, really, I mean, I do. A lot of times when I get stuck, she's the one I call, and I'm like, I need a story idea. And she's like, somebody lives in a trailer with 14 dogs. And then I write the story that was in LA 1K, Gilded Bones. That story came from her saying that.
Ah.
So, and, like, in Nefarious Muse, like, there were a couple of, there was a conversation. One of the stories from there was based on a conversation that we had. So, yeah, when I get stuck, she's, like, my go-to.
Okay, nice.
So, we're going to do one more before we sort of move on. We might come back
sort of
to this.
We'll come back. We'll come
and
back.
The, I'm going to the question that I want the answer to the most.
Oh.
Is Craig Walwork says, I understand that Amanda and co-host of Books and Booze, Jessica, share a little Appalachian history that involves grandfathers and tobacco. Would both you and Jessica please let us know the connection?
Oh, gosh. I didn't know you'd pick that one. But I saw a Facebook post that Amanda made about tobacco or something to that effect. And I was like, I grew up on a tobacco farm. I was raised by my grandparents, which was wonderful. And my grandpa,
yeah.
My grandpa was a tobacco farmer, and so I was a child tobacco farmer. He stripped tobacco in our basement, and my job was to keep him company. Or I thought that was my job, so I would stay down there.
That's the thing. Yeah, and my grandfather was a tobacco farmer. That was what he did, and I spent most of my childhood like at their farm, like around tobacco plants and helping.
So this is weird, but my grandfather was a tobacco farmer in Kentucky, but I don't have any experience with it because then he moved to California and became a teacher.
My grandfather lived in California for several years, and then he moved back to Kentucky to become a tobacco farmer.
This conversation is getting a little surreal.
I know.
We're
all related.
Your grandfather and my grandfather are like the opposite. They're like the bizarro versions of each other.
Yeah. I look at my childhood like whatever is one step better than rose-colored glasses. Like, I just love everything, every memory I have of being on that tobacco farm.
Yeah, I feel the same way. And there's, like, there's something sort of, like, there's like, a lot of magic in, like, getting to spend, like, that time, like, just outside and in, like, the farm environment where you just don't see anything other than like animals and plants, and I don't think that people understand that tobacco plants are very soft and they make beautiful flowers, and and that you hang them upside down, and the leaves. And I remember we used to play like Star Wars. We would use the tobacco sticks as like lightsabers and just beat the crap out of each other, like in the yard, and then we would try to use them to build things in the barn. And do you remember the tobacco setters? Is that what they were called? Like,
uh-huh.
Where the water comes down and you put the little sprout in the shoe and then it goes to. Yeah. Yeah. That's all like all the stuff that I haven't thought about in years.
It was lovely that very early they let me sit on the tobacco setter because I thought it was like amusement park ride. I didn't know.
Right. So
I would help. It was a two-person, the one we had. I don't know if that's standard, but it was two-person. So me and my mom would usually sit on it, and I'd put the plants in. Well, I would always probably plant at least one upside down. My grandfather would walk every single row himself later to find the ones that I had done upside down. And, anyway, he was a saint, but he was very good to me with the tobacco setting and all that stuff. So.
Yeah.
Happy times.
Yeah, very happy times.
I never pass a field without feeling a little bit of happiness in my soul. So.
Yeah, it's true. All the good memories.
I was happy to see Craig remember.
That was fun. That was a cool little bird walk we went on right there.
Yeah.
It might be the beer. Might have been that moment, but I feel warm and fuzzy.
So.
It's the moonshine.
That's right.
I was at a wedding over the weekend where they had a moonshine bar.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah. Oh, my God. And it all tasted really amazing. Like, these guys were, like, expert moonshiners. So I was
because, it's not just, moonshine. I mean, there's honeysuckle moonshine. I mean, people really underestimate the different types of moonshine that,
There's apple.
Everybody I've ever known that makes moonshine, the moonshine is terrible. But these guys, a lovely gay redneck couple, as they describe themselves. I'm sorry, queer rednecks. They have like an apple pie moonshine and a peach moonshine and a cherry. I didn't really like the citrus ones. I felt like I could taste the alcohol in those, but the other three, they were a danger. So.
I have had the apple. And I've had honeysuckle, but I've not had anything farther than that.
You should meet these guys. These they call them, well, it was queer rednecks. They call themselves Quednecks, which I thought was hilarious. Anyway, Jessica, you had some really strong feelings about Amanda's story in the book anthology.
Okay. I normally will not admit how close my research runs to airtime, but I read your short story in Booked, in the Booked anthology, which don't know, Booked is another podcast. They're equally as good.
I love them. I just have to say that. I love them, and they've been ridiculously good to me, and I don't know why.
They're
I'm a mess on there, yeah.
We have
wonderful.
Nothing but respect for Booked. I feel like they paved the way for little guys like us. But I'm just reading that story tonight. I cried at the end a little, and my boyfriend was next to me on the couch. He's like, "What's wrong with you?" I was like, "Nothing." And he said, "Is it sad?" I was like, Not exactly sad, but I don't know. So I was a little worried about talking about it, but I think I'm going to be fine now.
That makes me feel really good because that story, like, meant, like, a lot to me. Like, it was something, like, totally innocent, you know, but it ended up meaning, like, a lot. Like, it was one of the few things that I've ever written that when I was done with, I was actually like, I like this, which doesn't happen very often, as you know. Like, you don't finish something and you're like, I think this is good. Like, that very rarely happens, but you feel, like, good about, you know.
I had a strong reaction to your story, and the title is Short Tendon. And even trying to retell it, the museum that's in the story, and I don't want to give a whole lot away because it is a short story, but there's a museum, and it talks about the museum isn't everything the world used to be, but it's just everything that the person who runs it wants to remember about the world. And something about that just, like, touched my heart a little bit. it's beautiful in that way. So anyway, bravo.
Thank you.
For getting me to cry about it. Where did the story come from, I guess, is the first question.
I have a short tendon in my pinky. I can't straighten my finger all the way.
Oh.
That's, you know, there was a writing prompt that came for something, I mean, like I said, it started, like, innocently enough as something I thought, I think I can try this. I've never written anything even remotely sci-fi or dystopian or anything like that. And there was, like, somebody put out a call for submissions, and I didn't really have any ideas. And then I started thinking about the fact that, you know, like, my finger wouldn't straighten all the way. And then I started thinking about all of the Twilight Zone episodes that I'd ever seen. What was this? There's a specific one where you go in and you choose your body.
Yeah.
There was a specific one, you go in and you can pick a 1 or a 2 or a 3 or 4 or 5, and the girl doesn't want to do it. And, like, I think that kind of mixed together with the fact that, you know, but the whole short tendon thing is, like, and my left pinky doesn't straighten out all the way, and it looks really, really odd. And people always comment on my hand, like, flatten your hand out. And I'm like, no, it's not going to do that. It's just going to stick up funny like that. It's all crooked. So it just sort of evolved for me staring at my hand into, like, writing that story.
And it's also, there's twins in this story, right?
There are always twins.
there's more twins.
They're everywhere. There are always babies and there are always twins. But there are usually babies and there are usually twins. There's a lot of, like, mother-daughter-sister things going on. So, and a lot of
it is
right.
It's an incredibly different feel from your story in Cypher Sisters. You know, it's got this futuristic body modification stuff going on. Feels completely different. And then I was like, but wait a minute. They're twins. There's twins again.
Right.
So there's still...
Yeah, some of the same, you know, themes tend to crop up. I'm fascinated by twins.
It works. one of the quotes I really loved out of that one was, first they blend in, then they stand out. And that's something the Grand Mayor says to them. And I think it was really...
I think that that's very true, like about changes.
Yes, it really spoke to the fads of what was happening and the cycle of what you were seeing in the story, where people, you know, first they wanted, you call it the god hair, and that's like natural hair colors, and then they would stand out with like the purple and the blue and all that, and it was very natural progression. But I think that sentence really, really summed it up. First they blend in, and then they stand out.
Yeah, that's how technology sort of sneaks up on us. That's what happened.
That's true. I can see that. Do you still have your cell phone, Amanda?
I'm on my cell phone. Do I have my cell phone? Is that what you said?
Yes. I'm sorry. That sounded super creepy. I didn't mean it.
I was like, this is weird.
I'm sorry. I feel like I just...
Are you behind me?
From inside the house. No. Okay, the reason my brain works in very mysterious ways. And that you just said something about technology, and I remember not long ago, or maybe it was a year ago, sometime since I've known you on Facebook, you having some sort of post about cell phones and wanting to not use
I got rid of my smartphone and I've never gone back.
Smartphone, okay. That's
I got rid of the because
crazy.
we don't use like the house phone. We don't have like a house phone now. We just have the cell phones. But no, I gave up the smartphone and it's made like a lot of difference like in my life, like more difference than it should make in anyone's life. Because I wouldn't call myself, like, one of the people that are on it, you know, that was on it a lot. You know, like, comparatively speaking, where you're in a restaurant and you see people all, like, on a date and they're holding hands across the table, but in their other hands they have their phones. So it's like, what? It's, you know, and you start to see things like that and you have to take a step back. And, yeah, I'm really glad I got rid of the smartphone because now when I go places I stick books in my purse. I take things with me. I watch people, which I didn't realize were things that I did before, you know, like taking notes or like just paying attention to what people are doing, which unfortunately people used to do a lot more interesting things than they are now because usually they're just playing with their phones. Because, you know, some of the most interesting times to watch people are when they're waiting and they have to waste time. And people used to do a lot of really, really interesting things when they had 10 minutes to kill. Like they would sort of sing to themselves, or they would people watch, or they would whistle, or they would twiddle their thumbs, or they would make lists, or they would look at the clouds, or they would talk to strangers. But now they just look at their phones, and it's really, you know, kind of sad. It makes people watching less interesting, but I still think
I do. I'm probably never going to get rid of my smartphone because whatever. I do institute, like, even, and I don't say it just because, like, my husband's on it. I say it, like, for my own benefit to remind me. But, like, okay, like, we're not having our phones out for a little while. Like, it's not going to happen. We're going to talk to each other, and we're just going to hang out. And, like, be aware of how often it's, like, in your hand while you're doing something else. And trying to, you know, focus on the people you're actually with every once in a while.
Right.
I've actually known couples that have had serious trouble in their relationship because one of them was always on Facebook or whatever because they always had it in their pocket. And so they would be together but really they're not because they're constantly checking whatever is happening. I don't even have a cell phone. I have a landline. I'm really weird, but
no, that's fine. That's totally like be fine with that. Just, you know, own that and go with it. It's, you know.
Luckily, she resides with someone who has a cell phone because we did lose you a couple of times in St. Louis.
Yes, that is true. My boyfriend does have a cell phone, and God bless that he does, because, yeah, there are times when you need that. You need to be able, like when we were in St. Louis, we needed to be able to get in touch with people and that kind of thing. Besides that, like on a day-to-day basis, I just didn't need it. And I had like a prepaid one, but I was just paying like $25 every 90 days for nothing. So I was like, that's never
mind. Well, and when you go from like, the thing with switching from like a smartphone back to a regular cell phone was like, it was totally like, totally humbling, because like I had to like come to terms with the fact that like seriously nothing really important like needed my attention, you know, that like couldn't wait until the end of the day when I had time to sit down at like a computer. Nothing. No one needed me that badly. You know, like there was no email that like I needed to get right then. You know, I didn't need to, you know, find out this information. Like there was no. I don't have that kind of life. I understand like, and you know, a lot of people, the smartphones like really do streamline their lives and they really do help. But with me, it's like, you know, yeah, I can do without carrying around like a Facebook app, and I can wait until I get home to check my email. I'm fine. Nobody's really looking for me.
Everybody who listens knows, especially since we had Robert Brockway on, that I'm a huge fan of crack.com. And they had, they do these contests like where they have their, like the people who love cracked, do Photoshop contests, and one of them was realistic ads for popular products, and there was like a picture of an iPhone that said $500 Facebook sticker.
Yeah. that's pretty much it.
So before we get any closer to running out of time, we want to make sure that we give you a moment to talk about your sister's charity, and explain how you're involved and what they do. And I've already forgotten the name of it, even though Jessica said it earlier, so I'm going to let Jessica say the name.
Oh, that's okay. It's kind of complicated, but not really complicated. It's just one of those things that, like, it deals with conditions that people haven't really heard much about. So, you know, like, whatever opportunity that I can, you know, to get to talk about it. It's my cousin, Sarah, and her husband, Mike DeTurla. They have adopted three children since they've been married, and they both have grown children, so they're an older couple. And the youngest child, their daughter that they've adopted, she has tuberous sclerosis. It's very difficult to say. It's a brain disorder. She has seizures. She deals with pancreatitis. And they run the Marley Factor Foundation, which is their daughter's name is Marley. And they help advocate special needs adoptions. They help families. They deal with children with special needs and older couples that are thinking about adoption or couples that are thinking about adopting children with special needs. They help support children with special needs, like through their foundation and through fundraisers and different things like that. Like when we have, like, they do fundraisers a couple of times a year. Like they did an Easter fundraiser, and I went and painted bunny faces and things on kids. And then for our little local Apple Festival, Town Festival, like they had a booth and sold things there. And we worked in that. And my cousin Sarah's husband, Mike, has written a book like about their journey about adoption, like as being an older couple plus a couple that has adopted children with special needs. And it's going to be, he's going to self-publish this in November. And the title as of right now is, hold on, I wrote this down, Special Needs Adoptive Journeys of an Older Couple. And it's by Michael F. DeTurla. And it is coming out in November of 2013. And a large portion of the proceeds will go to supporting the families that they pick specific children that they help support. And then they also give to different charities that work with special needs adoptions. So, like, it's a really hard one, like, someone that you know, like, especially a relative says, like, I wrote this book, will you read it? You're just like, oh, I don't want to do it. Because you don't know what it's going to eat. I mean, you have no idea, because this people do it all the time. They write a book, you know, and they're like, you're going to know what to do with this. Here, read this. And he's like, I don't want to do this. And so then, like, I felt really bad because, like, Sarah sent me Mike's book, and I started reading it, and I was like, oh, my God, he can really write. This is, like, a really good story. Like, he somehow took, like, the adoption of, like, these three children and broke it apart into, like, a way that you can follow it, and it's really interesting, and he's a really good storyteller. I mean, he worked in journalism for a really long time, but you just never know, like, as far as, like, when people are telling a nonfiction account of their lives, like, how well it's going to come across, like, as far as just, you know, to be perfectly honest, how readable it's going to be. And right. It's actually really, really good. And I thought people will want to read this, whether or not they are interested in, you know, special needs adoption or being an older couple interested in adoption at all. You know, it's actually just an interesting book. So I was like, yes, I will try to, you know, like, whatever you need, like, tell me. I feel like crap, but I thought this was, you know, maybe not going to be great, but I had no idea. This is a really good book, like, on the merit of being a good book alone. So, yeah, that'll be out next month.
Awesome. Make sure you give us a heads up when that comes out, and we'll link it up.
I will. The Facebook pages that they have for that, there's Prayers for Marley, and they put most of their news through that. And then there's also a Facebook page for the Marley Factor Foundation. And it's Marley, M-A-R-L-E-E. So those are pretty easy to find.
Okay,
great.
I'll just say, from a little bit of personal experience, I worked with special needs high school students for several years, and I can attest to the fact that it's really important that the potential adoptive parents, like, have the information and support that they need, and that these kids get into great families. Because I know, like, we had a family, they had, like, five or six adopted children, all with varying levels of special needs, and it can be incredibly stressful, but it can also be incredibly rewarding, and it's really cool to see people have, like, an awesome, happy, healthy family all dealing with these issues that other people don't really understand. So that's just my little personal anecdote. So I think now we're going to try to get the rest of those listener questions in.
Yeah.
If that's possible.
As much as I can. I want one, because I think this is lovely. Jay Slayton Jocelyn asked, if you could dress your incredibly awesome son up as one literary character, who would it be?
Oh, gosh, does it have to be a character? Because I immediately came up with a writer.
Oh, well, okay.
My son, he would make a wonderful Mark Twain. He's a little smart ass. He's a little 5-year-old witty smart ass. He is. He would be perfect with a little pipe and a mustache. And, yeah, he would just tell you what's what. He would make a really good Mark Twain. That was the first thing that popped into my head, was, like, I just pictured him.
I feel
like sitting there,
like,
just
a 5-year-old Mark Twain would just be freaking adorable anyway.
Well, he could pull it off, too. I mean, he's
a little
very... Yeah, he's I'll just say Spitfire, because that's the best way to Spitfire, yeah, it's something else. So, yeah, I would have to say Mark Twain. So I don't know if that's a literary character, if that counts, but, yeah.
Well, technically, Mark Twain was a character.
He really was, yeah, he was, you know.
It was not only a pen name, but it was a style of writing and a set of topics that he adopted in order to sell books.
Yeah, so I think definitely counts.
So Craig Walbrook has another interesting one. Hmm. He says, according to Wiki, Appalachia has been a source of enduring myths and distortions regarding the isolation, temperament, and behavior of its inhabitants. Can you tell me something about that region that I will never find in a book or on the internet?
Wow. I have this, like, oh, God, I have this theory. It's a horrible, I mean, it's not a horrible theory, but, like, it's not really a horrible theory, but I would think it would be, like, kind of an unpopular theory, like, in an age, like, when people are trying to kind of get past racism.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. See, you're getting nervous already, right? but, like, there's like, I don't know how Jessica feels about this or if she's really thought about this, but, like, everybody in Appalachia seems to think that they have, like, Native American blood and, like, everybody's got Cherokee relatives. Jessica, I'm right, right? You have, like, you get Cherokee in your family, right? Okay?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
So do you honestly, like, think, though, that, like, it could, seriously, like, it's more acceptable to be Native American than it is to be African American in our area of the country? And do you think that, like, that mainly that whole, like, I got Indian blood in me is mainly, that's just, no, honey.
No, you don't. Yes, it's
no,
like,
not well, really. That's just that's a very convenient cover-up for, you know, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's something you have, probably.
He told us that he had Cherokee in him, and he was also a little bit racist. So I'm going to support his theory.
Yeah, see, and that was what was funny is I actually, like, when I read that whole thing about, like, when Johnny Depp came out in Zorro and he said that, like, he had Cherokee blood, it's like I read that and I laughed because I was like, oh, my God, he's from Kentucky. Like, he's black, too.
That's
they
what we wanted. Say, yeah.
Yes. But so that's not something you're going to read anywhere. But I think that that's seriously, like, it was more socially acceptable to say that the dark skin came from Native American blood, even though that is true. I mean, you can trace it back and go, okay, yes, Golden Hawk. I can't remember, like, his white name that they gave him or whatever, had, like, 29 women or whatever and, like, something like, I don't even know how many, like, wives and girlfriends he had. But, like, I think, like, it's just mainly him. And, like, he's the source for, like, everybody claiming that, like, they have Cherokee blood. It's just Golden Hawk. It was just him.
It's
otherwise,
like,
it's just, like,
up,
a massive, like, racism cover-up.
Every bit of my looks I got from my dad's side. And I have really, really dark eyes that are they're so brown, they're almost black. And everybody always said, oh, it's because we had Indian blood in our side. I'm like,
mm-hmm.
What?
Yeah, yeah.
Where?
Yeah.
No. Yeah. Stop saying that.
It's like wink, wink, nudge, nudge, you know. Yeah, that Indian blood. So, yeah, I don't think that's going to be on, like, Wikipedia anywhere.
That is brilliant, though, because, yes, absolutely, 100%.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Love
that. Thank you for sharing that theory with me, because, yeah, I was like, yeah, that's just so all Johnny Depp. You're Cherokee. Me, too. Me, too. I'm Cherokee, too. We're all a little bit Cherokee.
You're
in the hills.
Bit. It's like you're proud to be a little Cherokee.
you know, and thanks to that, we have all of these horrible little, like, you know, those little decorations that you can buy at gas stations with, like, the Native American one with the huge bosoms and the wings. It's all pretty,
yeah.
You know, to perpetuate that mess.
So I think my question, Nick Corpin asked a question, and I want to modify Nick Corpin's question, because it says, do llamas have their own species-specific version of doggy style, or is that term all-encompassing? I want to know why they're asking you weird llama questions. I don't care about
also
what
weird turtle questions.
I want to know
the
story behind
turtle,
why they're asking you these animal questions.
Because there's
okay,
a turtle question and an animal sex and general question as well. There are a lot of questions about different animals copulating.
Well, that's because we live, like, in the sticks. And,
yeah,
like, we have horses, we have dogs. Across, like, the road from us, like, our neighbors have horses. Our other neighbors had, like, two pet ducks. And then, like, another neighbor across the road, they sort of, like, almost have, like, a hobby farm. And they have llamas, miniature donkeys, regular-sized donkeys, rabbits, chickens, horses, miniature horses, I can't, like, everything that you can, like, imagine, it's, like, over there. They had a couple of turkeys for a while. They might be over there still. They have a lot of barn cats, of course, you know. But, yeah, they have llamas. So you're, like, looking out the window at, like, llamas. And, like, I, you know, may have, like, on the first time I was on books, you know, I was really nervous. So I started talking about, like, you know, playing ball in the yard with my son and, like, the llamas just started going at it and, like, how, like, but, like, you know, and this is, like, always happening. It's just one of those things where it's, like, look away. You know, like, this is, I know that they're making a lot of noise. Like, they're loud. But, like, as far as, like, if they have, like, a special, like, way, like, llamas are, like, really dramatic about everything. Like, they just do anything. They don't do anything, like, just do it. Like, they don't just, like, eat. Like, they will, like, lie down on the ground flat and, like, stretch their necks out to eat hay because it's like, I'm not going to get up and eat. Like, why would I do that? Like, that's how they eat, like, a lot of times. Like, no, I'm not going to stand up. And, like, when they spit, like, they, you can only tell when they spit because it's like they're cranking up, like how you would, like, crank something up to, like, work up the spit. Like, their necks will go back and forth, like, and it's like they're crank, and then they spit at people. And, like, we could see all of this out the windows because, like, children will walk down the street, like mean little teenage boys, and be like, I'm going to taunt the llamas, and we'll see the llamas start to do head cranking back where they're, like, building up the spit. And then you see all the kids go, oh, you know, because they just got llamas all over them. But, like, that, like, weird neck crank up, like, thing that they do, like, that's dramatic, like, is involved in, like, a lot of their acts. Like, they, you know, like, one time I saw this llama, I looked out the window, and he was doing something, you know, he was doing this weird neck crank up, and he was putting, like, all four of his feet, you know, like, he was gathering them all together, and he was, like, hunching all up and everything, and I was like, what is going on? Something really, like, special is going to happen here, like, he's going to do something weird, like, I don't know what's going to happen, you know, like, he's going to shed his llama skin and, like, fly away as, like, a Pegasus or something, you know, it's, like, you know, he was, like, fluffing himself all up and, like, cranking his neck and getting his feet, you know, like, together and doing all that. I'm like, what's going on? Like, he's going to have, like, a seizure or turn into, you know, like, shed his cocoon. And he took a crap. Like, it was just really dramatic, though. He couldn't just, like, take a crap like any other animal. He had to, like, make, like, this huge spectacular show of it and do all this fantastic neck cranking, posing, fluffing stuff.
We're out of time. what's your way to go out? Yeah, to be honest here. So anyway, apologies to any listener questions we didn't get to. As you may have noticed, it was a jam-packed show. We're going to do what we always do. We're going to listen to a song. You finish up your drink. And make sure you catch us next week, which will be airing on Halloween next week. So,
ooh.
For sure it might be scary. It probably won't.
And it will be.
It's possible.
Do you know who it's going to be next week, Renee?
We're going to have the return of Scott McClanahan.
Yeah. Hopefully
on
the
show.
Return.
Next week. And we're going to try really hard not to yell at him.
I feel like I was baited last time. This time, no. We're talking about what he writes.
That's right. We know the game now. We know the game now, and we're prepared. So he better be prepared. Anyway, thank you so much for doing the show this week, Amanda. It was a great show. We had a lot of fun.
This was wonderful.
Thanks for having me on. Thank you. It's a lot of fun.